The clear message of the scriptures is that the way up is the way down. Now that is a message that runs counter to the spirit of the world. The world teaches that you should not be out to humble yourself, that instead you should be out to sell yourself and all of your supposed abilities, even if it means that you have to shade the truth in the process. For the world, the way up is the way up. The world teaches that those who project the image of humility and meekness will never amount to anything. But that which counts so much with the world is a thing of no consequence to God. For those social climbers, those career climbers who are always scheming on their next step in their campaign to promote themselves, those who have become adept at brazenness, God has a very clear message. In the book of Deuteronomy, through which we have been reading in our morning worship services, the prophet Moses, the man of God, sought to review and to place in perspective for the children of Israel the experiences through which they had passed during the previous 40 years. Now, not all of them had witnessed all of those experiences. Some had been born, obviously, during that period. But all of those who were 20 years old and younger at the time of Kadesh Barnea did survive to see the Promised Land. And so, for them, Moses was recounting their experience. And there had been times of severe trial, and there had been times of singular blessing. Moses sought to emphasize the truth that both kinds of those experiences had come to them directly from the gracious hand of the Most High God, so that the review of the past, the teaching of history, if you will, was a tool by which to exhort the people regarding the future. He would have them remember what had taken place so that they would not forget the cause of what had taken place. In this chapter, Moses was warning the people about the dangers in the future, dangers that could befall them, that would befall them once they had become settled in the Promised Land. And what was he concerned about? Well, in the verses that we did not read in our Bible reading in Deuteronomy 8, he was concerned that once all of the struggles of the wilderness and the campaign of conquest were a memory, and the people were settled down in the land and enjoying the blessing that God had promised them, that they would forget God, that they would develop spiritual apathy. He was concerned that they would abandon the very one whose blessing had brought them so far. So Moses wanted them to remember that even the trials through which they had passed had been in the context of God's faithfulness to them as their covenant God. The danger they would face would be that the blessing of God would make them forget the God of the blessing. So Moses wanted them to remember God's reasons in all that he had done for his people. He was reminding the people concerning why it is that the Lord does certain things. In the words of our text, we are told just why God did lead Israel in the way that He did. And by application, we're told why He leads all of His people in the way that He leads them. So this evening, let us consider the purpose of divine direction. The purpose of divine direction. Now, it is striking that this morning we were considering the way in which Ruth was being guided by the unseen hand of God's providence, even in so mundane a decision as what field she should enter to glean in. Well, the lesson of the farewell sermon by Moses was that often God's leading of His people does not seem to make sense to them while it is being executed. Many times it's not until after the fact, when there is time for reflection, that the hand of divine providence emerges clearly enough for His people to understand, oh, that is why that happened. The lesson in Ruth's situation was that even if the purpose of God is apparently concealed while it's being carried out, it's just as certain that God's purpose will be carried out. So whether Ruth was aware of it, and she was not, whether the children of Israel were conscious of the reason for God's dealing with them, and often they were not, God's purpose was being achieved. In other words, we cannot derail the purpose of God. There are times when you may wonder why circumstances have fallen out in a certain way in your life individually, in the life of the church. You may wonder sometimes why it is that trouble seems to come all in bunches, why trouble seems to come in large doses at times, and at other times there doesn't seem to be much trouble at all. Why is that? Why couldn't it be spread out so we could deal with it a little more effectively? You see, we tend to get the idea in our heads that the years that the children of Israel spent in the wilderness were made up of one day of trouble after another. You know, we get this idea that they for 40 years they were in the wilderness, and every day, oh no, another day of this, and getting up and slogging through the wilderness, not understanding why this was all happening, and that every day was going to be like that. But that wasn't the case at all. There were many days during those 40 years that passed by without anything extraordinary happening, except for the miracle with which every one of those days but one in seven began. And that was the collection of the manna. But in terms of severe trials and the routine of life, there were many days that were very ordinary. And then there were some when they knew the severity of affliction. And that's going to be your experience. Most of life is made up of the routine. It's made up of the things that happen every day. You go through the day and you go through the week, and the week has a certain structure to it. There are things that you do at this time of the week and things that you do at that time of the week. And that is just the pattern of life. And most of the time, our lives are just conducted in that routine. There are times when that routine is upset, either by our own action or by things that come upon us. But the question is, when trouble comes, how do you meet it? Well, if you can remember the message of our text this evening, you will be able to meet it with the confidence that the purpose of God lies behind what is happening, and that even if you don't know the details of that purpose, you can rest upon that purpose and be sure that, as far as you're concerned, it is a purpose for your good. Now, there are four things about divine direction in our text that I want you to consider this evening. And let's notice the first one. The prostration through divine direction. How did the people come into the wilderness? How did it happen that they were there? They were led there. Their Redeemer led them there. Look at the context. Look at the text in verse 15. And we find that it was the Lord, their God, the one who had brought them out of Egypt, who led them through that great and terrible wilderness. They were there because God led them there. In other words, we can say it was the will of God for them to be there. Sometimes, as I was saying this morning, we get a little bit confused in our thinking in terms of the will of God. Sometimes we convince ourselves it's the will of God for something to happen when we look at what actually does happen and it's at variance from what we were convinced the will of God was. Well, what is the answer to that dilemma? It's not that somehow God was stopped from carrying out His will. The answer is we were mistaken concerning what we thought God's will was. I heard a minister say that somebody had said to him that he was convinced that the will of God was for a certain thing to happen. And he said to him, well, obviously you're mistaken because that's not going to happen. The children of Israel had been brought out of the house of bondage in Egypt. And how had they been brought out? By the miraculous acts of God. They had been liberated. They had been set free. And what had they done in the immediate aftermath of that liberation? They had walked through the Red Sea on dry ground. Now, I know what all the skeptics say. Well, it wasn't that deep, really. And they just found a place that was dry enough. And well, the Egyptians were foolish when they drove their chariots in there. They got stuck in the mud and so on. What utter nonsense. The scriptures tell us that they walked through the Red Sea and the water was a wall to them on either side. And they could look into the water on either side and they could see fish swimming around in there. It was a wall. And they were walking through on dry ground. And the Egyptians, seeing that, said, let's go right in after them. And when they went into the sea came back over them and they were all drowned. That was a miracle. Now, some of the children who were part of that experience were still alive when Moses was speaking these words all those years later. They had been less than 20 years of age at the time. So they could remember that experience walking through the Red Sea. Now, I don't know what the experience was, but I would think to see the arm of God displayed in that way was an experience that would bring joy to every heart. But then right afterward, they went 3 days in the wilderness and they didn't have any water. And right away they wondered why God had put them in, not why God had put them in the position, but why Moses had put them in this position. They came to Kadesh Barnea. And what happened at Kadesh Barnea? They sent the spies in. The spies came back and said, yes, just as it has been said, this is a good land. It's a land flowing with milk and honey. But 10 of them said, you know, there are giants there. and there are cities that are walled up to heaven, we don't have a chance. We can't go in there. We'll be slaughtered. Joshua and Caleb said, no, the Lord delights in us. He'll bring us into that land and give it to us. But the others said, no, we can't do that. We'll be slaughtered. And so God turned them aside into the wilderness. And they would remain in the wilderness for 40 years. Now, I want you to notice something about their experience in that time that we find in the earlier part of the chapter. If you look at chapter 8 and verse 3, and he humbled thee and suffered thee to hunger and fed thee with manna, which thou knewest not, neither did thy fathers know, that he might make thee know that man doth not live by bread only, but by every word that proceedeth out of the mouth of the Lord doth man live. Thy raiment waxed not old upon thee, neither did thy foot swell these 40 years. They didn't have to get new clothes. Their clothes lasted for 40 years. What was God doing? He was demonstrating His ability to sustain them even in the midst of this place. And what was the wilderness like? It was a mapless desert. They didn't have any maps. They didn't know where they were going. They were dependent entirely for their direction of travel on the leading of God. The pillar of cloud by day and the pillar of fire by night. When that pillar moved, they moved. When that pillar stayed, they stayed. They couldn't say, even though some did try, that we should find a way back to Egypt. By this time, they had no clue as to how to get back to Egypt. And without the leading of the pillar of cloud and the pillar of fire, they would have been hopelessly lost. It was a vast place. And as we read in our text, it was a terrible place. Notice what's pointed out. Sounds like a description of the desert southwest here. It was a wilderness wherein were fiery serpents and scorpions and drought, where there was no water. Oh, yes, they encountered the wildlife, the serpents and the scorpions, and they encountered the deprivation of not having enough water. It's easy for us to take water for granted, but I guarantee you they did not. Every day that was one of the things on their minds. Will we have enough water today? They were dependent on God alone for their food. Notice what he said. I was just struck by this as we were reading it. In verse 16, he fed thee in the wilderness with manna, which thy fathers knew not, that he might humble thee. He fed thee with manna, something that your fathers, that is your fathers and grandfathers and great-grandfathers who lived in Egypt, they didn't know anything about that. He fed you with manna, and that was for the purpose of humbling you. If we had written it, we would say it was for the purpose of feeding them. But that wasn't the purpose. The people, through all their experiences, were being prostrated. They were being humbled. Everything on which they had taught themselves to rely was being removed from them. And they had to confront the truth that they had no resources. That's what I say. They were being prostrated. Now, they didn't like the idea, some of them. But they had to face the fact that if it weren't for that manna, they would all starve. If it weren't for the water, as we read in verse 15, that God had provided in bringing forth water out of the rock of flint, if it weren't for that reality, they would die from thirst in very short order. God brought them into the wilderness to take away from them all the things on which they would rely. And it is to that place that God brings His people so that they may learn to rely on Him and grow in faith. The prostration through divine direction. But notice as well in our text the provision in divine direction. That is, when the people were in such dire straits, God did not abandon them there. He sustained them. We read at the end of verse 15, He brought forth water to them out of the rock. In verse 16, He fed them with manna. So that they could say that every day they witnessed a miracle. Every day when the dew dried up from the face of the ground, they found manna on the ground. And they went out and they collected that manna. And they collected it and they were able to bake it or to cook it or to do whatever they wanted with it, but to use it. And it was of such a nature that it provided all the nutrients that they needed to sustain their lives. This was a miracle. God providing for them in ways that seemed to be impossible. The rock was like flint. It was hard. But God made water to come out of it. Something that seems impossible. Today it seems that this provision, spiritually speaking, is impossible. In the midst of such a wilderness, how can God provide spiritual food and spiritual water in the midst of a wilderness? But there's a great promise given to the people of God in the prophecy of Isaiah chapter 41. Isaiah chapter 41. And let's look at verse 17. When the poor and needy seek water, and there is none, and their tongue faileth for thirst, I, the Lord, will hear them. I, the God of Israel, will not forsake them. I will open rivers in high places, and fountains in the midst of the valleys. I will make the wilderness a pool of water and the dry land springs of water. That actually happened physically in the wilderness. That is, the children of Israel witnessed that phenomenon where they were in a place where there was no water and seemed to be no way in which that water could be provided, but God made it come forth out of the rock. And He didn't make it come forth out of the rock in a little trickle, like sometimes you get out of the fountain out in the hallway here. It wasn't a trickle, it was a torrent. So it flooded the whole area. There were streams of water. God is providing for His people that which they must have to prosper in the work He has given them to do. That leads me, thirdly, in our text to speak about the probation of divine direction. I've already spoken a little bit about this part of the purpose of God. It was for the purpose of humbling the people, removing everything on which they had accustomed themselves
to rely. What does God want His people to learn? What does He want them to remember? He wants them to remember that apart from Him, they are nothing and they have nothing. Our Lord Jesus Christ taught His disciples concerning this great reality. In the Gospel of John chapter 15, He said, "I am the vine and ye are the branches. Except the branch abide in the vine, it bears no fruit. Without me," He said to them, "ye can do nothing." Nothing. So many times we find in the language of the hymn writer, we find that our service is barren and dry, and the reason it is because it's done without Christ. God wants His people to be reminded that He is the sovereign over them. In the prophecy of Jeremiah, there's a very famous and very vivid illustration of this sovereign prerogative of God in chapter 18. Chapter 18 and verse 1. "The word which came to Jeremiah from the Lord, saying, Arise, and go down to the potter's house, and there will I cause thee to hear my words. Then I went down to the potter's house, and behold, he wrought a work on the wheels. And the vessel that he made of clay was marred in the hand of the potter. So he made it again another vessel, as seemed good to the potter to make it. Then the word of the Lord came to me, saying, O house of Israel, cannot I do with you as this potter, saith the Lord? Behold, as the clay is in the potter's hand, so are ye in mine hand, O house of Israel." Jeremiah went to look at the work of the potter. There he was on the potter's wheel, making some vessel, and there was something about it that didn't please him. It was marred in his hand. And so what did he do? He wrecked that vessel. He crushed that vessel, made it back into a lump of clay, and set it back on the wheel to make something else. And no one could come in and say to him, "Why are you doing that? Why are you destroying that so that you can make something else? What gives you the right to do that?" He would say, "I'm the potter. This is my clay. This is my wheel. I can do as I wish with it." And so the Lord uses that illustration to convey to us the truth that we are clay in His hands. And He has the ability to make of us whatever He wants, and it is for His purpose. It is for His glory. That is why I say that God's purpose was to humble them in the wilderness. It was to put them down to the place where they would learn not to look to themselves, but to look only to Him, to refine their faith, so that in the memorable language of Job, when God has tried His people, they will come forth as gold. Job was one who knew this probation. He knew this humbling. But what was Job's testimony? "God knoweth the way that I take. When He hath tried me," he didn't know why he was being tried. He didn't know what direction that trial would take. But he said, "When He has tried me, I will come forth as gold." Why? Because it is God who's doing it. This is the probation of this divine direction. And last of all in our text, the promotion by divine direction. Here's the glorious aspect of our text in verse 16. "That He might humble thee, and that He might prove thee, to do thee good at thy latter end."
Moses was saying to the people, you remember all those days in the wilderness? How could they forget them? Remember all those trials? Remember all those days when you didn't know if there'd be any water? Remember all that? Why did God do that? He did it so that He could do thee good at thy latter end. And I submit to you, that is the hardest part of this whole text. It's hard for us to believe this is going to do us good. And I submit to you, it was hard for them to believe in those days in the wilderness, when they were going through these trials, when they were dealing with the fiery serpents and the scorpions. It was hard for them to believe, this is for our good at our latter end. But so it was. God often speaks about this aspect of His timing in His dealings with His people, that it's at the end that we need to look. Not while the situation is unfolding, but at the end. There is an expected end, a decreed end in view. Let's go again to Jeremiah and to chapter 29. Jeremiah 29 and verse 10. For thus saith the Lord, that after 70 years be accomplished at Babylon, I will visit you and perform my good word toward you in causing you to return to this place. For I know the thoughts that I think toward you, saith the Lord, thoughts of peace and not of evil, to give you an expected end. Now, when were those words said? Before Jerusalem ever fell. So the message was, Jerusalem's going to fall. The people are going into captivity. But here's the message to them. Remember, during all those times of trial, when they would be in Babylon and they would say, we wept when we remembered Zion. During all those times of trial, Jeremiah was saying, remember that after 70 years, God is going to visit you. That is, God is saying, I'm fixing a time. And when that time comes, I'm going to visit you. Why? Because He said, I know the thoughts that I think toward you. You may think those thoughts that I think toward you are of a different character, but God is saying, I know the thoughts I think toward you. And they are thoughts of good and not of evil. God does not think toward His people with thoughts of evil. God is not trying to destroy His people. His purpose is to bring them to the expected end. This is God's purpose. This is the purpose of His direction in our lives. Individually, in our families, in the life of the church, in the life of the denomination, in the life, we can say, even of the nation. This is God's purpose for His people. It is to bring them to an expected end. So that in all of His dealings with us, whatever our circumstances are, His design is for our good. And the best illustration we have of that is to look at Calvary. What does Calvary appear to be? The world looked at it and they said, this is the end of Jesus of Nazareth. They got Him at last. He'll never get out of this one. And even those who had been disciples of Christ, they thought it was the end. Remember those men on the road to Emmaus on the day of the resurrection? As they were talking, they didn't know it was with Jesus, but as they were talking with this man whom they supposed to be a stranger, what was it they said? We trusted that it had been He that would have delivered Israel. But it's over now.
the world looks at it and said, that's the end. And many of the Lord's people thought it was the end. But what was God's design? His thought in Calvary was toward His people. Thoughts toward them of good and not of evil, to bring them to an expected end. And what was that expected end? It was glory. It was victory. It was triumph. What was the expected end for the people to whom Moses was speaking? It was to bring them into the promised land that they might enjoy the fulfillment of all that God had said to the patriarchs, to Abraham and to Isaac and to Jacob. Oh, for the grace to learn this lesson. The purpose of God's direction. We'll see it unfolding in Ruth's experience as we continue our studies in Ruth. It was the purpose of God's direction for her. She didn't know it. But it was to bring her to an expected end. To bring her to the point where her name, and the name of Rahab, and the name of Bathsheba, and the name of Tamar. Those four women, I always think it's very striking that those four women are the ones who appear in the genealogy of Jesus Christ. One who played at being a harlot, one who was a harlot, one who was an idolater, and one who was an adulterer. But Ruth was brought to an expected end to be part of that line that led to the birth of Christ. What was God's point? God knows how to deal with that which is wicked and perverse, and to bring out of that which the world dismisses, that which is for the good of His people, for the honor of His name, for the glory of His kingdom. Let that be the encouragement for us in these days, in terms of our lives individually, in terms of our families, in terms of our church and our denomination, in terms of our country. God knows how to deal with His people for their good and for His glory.